Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. Did we talk about our SOBs show?
Our secret SOBs show?
The fact that we had a show at SOBs in New York City?
Oh, my God. You know, guys, we want to let you in on a little nugget of information that we haven't told too many people about.
We haven't put out dedicated episodes to it or anything.
No.
SOBs on January, I'm so used to saying it, January 10th, 2018, yeah. Be there.
It happened.
It happened. And thank you to everyone who came out, who supported, who stayed for 2 hours afterwards, like any good Jewish goodbye, and got kicked out by the staff of SOBs at the end of the night. We told stories about Vinny from Jersey Shore. We told stories about Harvey Weinstein. We told stories about Nick Cannon.
Air India.
Air India. That went over very well. We performed a whole bunch of our music. It was just great times. And
Upscale Vandal came out.
Who did a live version of Shark Tank on stage.
Yeah, he listened to ideas. And
the best part was we were like, hey, if anyone has anything that they want to talk about, you want to push your Casper mattress, you want to push your Squarespace account, you want to push your podcast, come on up here and talk about it. And Jeff was like, no podcast.
Everybody's got a podcast and
everyone wants to talk about their podcast.
Yeah, we don't need to hear anybody talk about their podcast.
But shout out to everyone who was in the audience who had a podcast and wanted to talk about that on stage and use our platform to
all 4,000 people who have podcasts. Congratulations. We know you have a podcast.
Yes, but congratulations to us. Another great showing by It's the Real, because that's what it said right behind us.
Yeah, perfect showing.
A perfect showing by It's the Real. There's going to be a lot more shows. Toronto, Los Angeles, Chicago, Atlanta.
Keep naming cities.
Philly, Washington, D.C.
Grand Rapids.
We're going to be...
Topeka.
Actually, we should mention, if you live anywhere near Northeast Ohio, and we're talking Cleveland or Akron, even Buffalo and Western New York.
Yeah, the lowlands of Kentucky. You know, any place where T. Grizzly robbed, wherever the Nappy Roots are from.
That's right. You guys should see us on January 28th. We know it is the same night as the Grammys.
Right. And we have wisely decided that we are going to forego all the parties surrounding the Grammys, and we will be in Northeast Ohio.
Lovely Akron.
Yeah.
In the middle of the winter.
Oh, I thought you were going to be like, in the middle of Ohio. It is...
We're doing a panel, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Shout out to Just Crisis. We're going to be talking about building a brand and being 10 years into the game.
I got to say, I take a little issue with the event because it says branding basics.
Yeah. Oh.
And I think that they're talking about us. Like, we're basic, and how are we going to brand ourselves?
Damn.
Yeah.
Well, wait, if we buy into that, if we're like, you know, enthusiastic about how basic we are.
Yeah.
Isn't that what we're talking about?
Then we have branded ourselves.
Yes, we are basics. Branding basics.
We need to figure out what we're going to do in Akron, because so far we've had a few people reach out to us and tell us what to do in Northeast Ohio.
Yeah.
Apparently there are strip clubs.
Yes.
That we can go to during the day.
Also strip malls.
Strip malls and strip clubs.
Yes.
The branding basics.
So if anyone has any idea as to what to do in Akron on a Saturday, Sunday,
no,
and part of a Monday.
We're only there for Sunday and Monday morning.
Oh, we fly in late on Saturday.
Yeah.
So if there's anything overnight that you want us to do.
Yeah. What's a crazy night in Akron like?
I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
January 28th is the date that we're going to be out there in Akron. We're going to be speaking on a panel. It's going to be a lot of fun. Come here. A lot of our stories, some of them will be true.
Yeah.
So look forward to that. Again, more live It's the Real shows. And thanks to everyone who came out to our show in New York. Jeff, today on the podcast.
Today on the podcast, we have New York Zone. Upper West Side Zone. Boston University Zone.
Wow. Rich Kleiman.
Rich Kleiman.
Who is Kevin Durant's partner in all of his businesses. He used to be Kevin Durant's agent. He used to be just Kevin Durant's buddy. He used to be just Jay-Z's buddy.
He used to be Wale's manager.
Yes.
He used to be a lot of things.
Solange's manager and Meek Mill's manager.
Yeah.
And there's a crazy story about his experience at Boston University that I don't want to ruin for the people out there.
Yeah.
But Rich Kleiman, who you may recognize from the very, very, very background of those Kevin Durant podcasts that he does with Bill Simmons, they don't mic Rich Kleiman very well, but Rich is there. If you wanted to hear his story and you wanted to hear him mic'd well,
then
is the podcast for you.
Then come to Death Row.
That's right.
I would say this podcast is great for a number of reasons, because Rich Kleiman, first of all, is a great storyteller and has so many stories to tell.
Rich Kleiman's story is one of overcoming long odds, believing in himself, outworking everyone else, finding his lane and dominating it, taking chances, getting co-signs from Heavy D, Puff Daddy, Mark Ronson, Q-Tip, Jay-Z, John Manili, J. Cole, Meek Mill, Wale, Victor Cruz, Kevin Durant, and on and on. Listen to how Rich, a man with no undergraduate degree, turned his unbelievable experiences around music and TV production and entrepreneurship into a master's degree in real life. Jeff, when do you want to get into this?
Right after I tell people, I want people to subscribe, but most importantly, to rate our podcast on iTunes.
You think that's the most important thing?
To rate?
I think
no. The most important thing is to listen.
Oh yeah.
Commenting would be great too.
Yes.
So do that.
All right.
Yeah. Listen to Eric, but also listen to me.
Great.
Yeah.
Jeff, when do you want to get into this?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, aka Flo Bananas, aka Gerber Baby Food.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, aka What's Slapping In, aka Fly Swatter.
I don't have one like that. I didn't even know that was coming. But what's up?
Well, just say who you are.
This is Rich Kleiman, aka Rich Kleiman.
Yeah, this is a waste of time, but this is the real. Rich, what's happening?
What's good, man? Energy.
Yeah.
Energy.
Yeah.
I like it.
You got your coffee?
I got coffee. It's my third coffee already.
Upper West Side Jew.
Oh, man. We are a dime a dozen, aren't we?
We really are. We saw you last on the actual West Side. We were at...
This is the actual West Side.
Well, yes, but we saw you on the West Side of this country of ours.
Oh, that's right.
We were at Lenny S.'s
Halloween party.
And you know how... I don't know if it was weird for you, but like being in a different city and walking into a room and everyone's in costume and like they expect you to know who they are.
Yeah.
Just like I didn't...
Honestly, you're the only two people I recognized the whole night. Were you guys even in costume?
I had an off-white... costume. I just put the word costume on my sweatshirt.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, I knew who you were.
Yeah. I'm glad you recognized me, even without.
I had a wig from the gas station and glasses because we landed. Where was flying from? I think Kevin had just had a game in the Bay, I think, or somewhere. We just flown into LA, found out Lenny was having a party, I've been to Lenny's first Halloween party, I think.
The year was 1967.
1967, man. Lenny's full name at that time was still Lenny Santiago.
That's right.
But I don't remember when it was, and I know it had grown into this like mandatory costume thing. So I didn't want to be that guy. So I went to the gas station,
You put in the least amount of work.
I got a wig and some glasses. But somehow I threw everybody off. When you've been bald since you were like 18 years old, you put hair on, no one has any idea who you are.
Really, 18?
I mean, I shaved my head when I was 18. I was in college and we went out. I went to a club one night and it was like, you know, I'm from the city, so we think that we really we partied, but I went to school and these people from like outside the city partied. They were like on another level. So I was whatever. So the party was insane and it was one of those like, oh my God. So I had never really done all that shit and seen all that shit. Woke up the next day, we're looking at pictures and everyone's like, look how fucked up we were. And I'm like, well, hold up. Look at my hair. Holy shit. I'm like, is that what my hair looks like? They're like, yeah, man, you bald shit. And I was like, it looked like I could see my scalp, like my head through everything. So I just shaved the shit that day. So I've been shaving my head since I was 18.
That was it?
That was it, man.
Oh my God.
I mean, everyone in my family, I knew it was happening. My brother was bald. My father's bald.
Really?
My mother's bald. My mother's not bald, but you know what I mean.
Is she a listener here?
She don't even know what a podcast is.
Where are you originally from?
Right here.
No, but where? Like,
here.
Where were you born?
Here.
Like Lenox Hill Hospital? Like where?
Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, yeah.
And
what about you guys?
I was born in Lenox Hill.
Oh, nice.
And then Jeff was born up in Westchester.
Yeah,
so.
Westchester.
Yeah. That's why you softer than
What up, St. Agnes out there in White Plains?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Why were they in Westchester for you?
We moved up. We got a big house up there.
Oh.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm a twin. And the house, you can't have, like, you know, a million kids in one room down here on Roosevelt Island.
Yeah.
So you moved to the burbs.
Yeah, that was it. That was it. Look at us now.
Look at you now.
And then 10 years on the Upper West Side.
All star-studded.
Yeah.
So what was growing up on the Upper West Side like?
Growing up in the Upper West Side, man, I was lucky. It was good. It was a nice place to grow up. You know, it was peaceful. It's beautiful. I think like in the city, the Upper West Side to me is funny because it's really like a haven. Like whenever I'm in Midtown in New York, I'm like, I gotta get the hell out of New York City. I don't want to live here no more. I want to live in LA. I want to live in Miami. I just want to get out of here. As soon as I get back to the Upper West Side, I remember why I live in the city. It's just like, and the West Village is the same way. And I lived in the West Village a little bit. So I'm fortunate. These are neighborhoods that like I was fortunate to live in.
Well, that's what they are. They're really neighborhoody.
They are.
Yeah, they're just quiet places.
Yeah. But I think the Upper West Side way more than the West Village or Tribeca is a different kind of culture that you're exposed to, even in living in a pretty affluent neighborhood, right? So it's like, I used to go play basketball, for instance, all the way up Broadway. Like, it was like almost like the better I got, the further uptown I would go.
Right.
Mm. And it led me to being like allowed in the gym at Riverside Church.
I literally mean allowed
in the gym because they never let me play. Like, but at that point, there was no AU level. So there was no like an A team, B team, C team, D team. So I just was allowed in the gym. Mm-hmm. I remember someone was like, the coach told Ernie Lorch was his name, and it's not even a good name to say. The guy fucked his whole life up.
Yeah.
But I remember they were like, yeah, you can come in the gym. And to me, that meant I played there. They gave me like a jersey. I never stepped on the court and played.
Really?
So I remember I was telling OG Juan that I played Riverside Church, and he was like, get the fuck out of here. You never played at Riverside. I'm like, I did. He's like, man, what team you playing? I'm like, I ain't playing any team. And he was like, what do you mean? I'm like, they just let me in the gym. But that was a big deal. So like, I went uptown and started playing on like 99th in Amsterdam. I played in the Midi Parks in 84th in Amsterdam, and then they became all my friends. So like, I was able to really get in to hip hop at such a young age, because I remember someone putting a Walkman on my ears when I was in like the fifth grade, and it was NWA, and I was just like, what the fuck? Like, they're just, fuck the police. I didn't even understand the message clearly, but the shit was just insane. And then I remember I was just like bang out to Gangsta Gangster. I just love it. So I'd be on like the Liberty Lines bus until 4 on my way to Fieldston.
Oh my God.
And then when I come home, I just like run to the park.
Yeah.
And throw that shit on. So
wait, did you go to Ethical to start?
Yeah, man. Tough Ethical culture.
Yeah,
dad,
yeah.
Bro, it's tough in there. It's tough, man. It's crazy.
Were you always like tall for your age?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what position were you playing in basketball?
No, but I like the again. Bench. It's really hard. It's really no. I was no, but no. I said at Riverside Church. But the thing is like, it's really tough for me to talk about sports now, because I'm around the greatest athletes in the world every day. So like, right. My stories are embarrassing.
Right? Well, do you ever tell Kevin you're just like, yo, I could wash you.
I always talk about basketball with him, and he's just like, the conversation is so abrupt, man. Like, I played one-on-one with his security guard last year, and I busted his ass, the security. I thought I was bumping. I was like, yo, you saw that shit? He's like, you're trash. And it's like, and I remember I was telling him this story once about how I chose to play basketball in my freshman year in high school, and I stopped playing football, but I thought I was really good at football. And he was like, why'd you stop? I was like, oh, I just wanted to focus on basketball. He's like, so you go pro? I'm like, no. I'm like, bro, what? I'm like, nah, the people at Ethical didn't have thoughts like that. Right. Like, you might have thought it, like, in this like weird subconscious, we knew the truth, which was like, we're right. Not playing basketball. But for my school and my group, I was that guy. But like,
well, who were the other schools that you would play against in your league?
Well, the obvious ones, you know, like the
Dalton
Tigers. But there was like a period in when our team, it's like in the Ivy League in college, how like Princeton was really good, right? And then like Harvard's really good and Penn's really good. So we had a run for like 2 or 3 years where we applied to play these like PSA tournaments and Catholic League tournaments. So we were able to go play in Glens Falls for the state championship. Truly like the Class B state championship. So Class
State.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we played against like, and we were, Norwich was there, which is Christian Leitner school. This school, I don't remember this. This other school, this guy Bob Laser was there. Everyone on these teams were going to Division I schools. So I was like, well, this is my time. They're like, I'm going to get recruited now.
Yeah.
You know? I'm going to get recruited. So I was a sophomore. Starting playing on this and this like state championship semifinals, all our families are up there, and they put out this like playbill. It was straight Hoosiers up there, like everyone's on the street with like signs, and it was 1995, but it could have been 1965. And I remember we were in like these vans on the way to the game, and it really felt like we were in like Hickory, Indiana,
right?
And I look, everyone's like running to the program, and it's like senior Tom Kleiman. I'm like, what? I'm like, first of all, I'm a sophomore. Second of all, it's Rich. Like, and you know, there's not like a computer program at this point. So like, that was it. I wasn't fixing the program. So I'm like, if any college coach is here, I'm clearly not blowing them away. And if they're even thinking about talking to me, they're like, well, nah, Tom's a senior. Fuck him. And I'm like, this shit is horrible. Then to top it off, we get blown out in the semis. And the paper, which I still have, is a picture of
Tom,
like Bob Lazor just posterizing Tom Kleiman. Oh. So that was it, man. I went to BU and like I was playing that like city bullshit, like telling everyone back home, like, yeah, I got a little scholarship.
But yeah,
like I was like, not really.
Boston University is not known for its basketball program.
No, hockey.
Yeah.
Go
yeah.
Terriers.
Yeah. So I went to BU. You went to BU. Yeah. I was there longer. talk about your BU experience.
No, I was not there long at all.
Yeah.
I went to BU and I just, my, like, again, like I told you, I thought we partied in New York, and then I got there, and I was like, these kids from outside the city are insane. He's like, I just never seen anything like it, so I just wilded it out, man. I just partied my ass off, and then I picked up, like, a little side business when I was in Boston, which is crazy, because now I'm, like, fully entrenched in the sports world, so it's probably taboo to say it, but it really doesn't matter now because I just work with Kevin.
Right. Yeah.
But I ran a bookie operation in college, right, and I crushed it, man. It was insane. I went up to school. It was 1995. It was the beginning of the year, and I went to this sports bar, and it was Mariners-Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember everybody was betting on the Yankees. And I'm a Met fan, so everyone's like, man, you know a bookie? I want to put like a, you know, 500 to win this or 1,000 to win this. I didn't have a dollar. And they're like, you know, you're college poor. I don't have any money. And my parents really, like, they were supportive of me till 18. But at 18, they just, that was it. They didn't give me a dollar.
Once you shaved your head, yeah.
Once I shaved my head, they're like, we're not, come on, man. So I remember I called my brother, who I knew was a degenerate gambler. And I was like, yo, these guys want to put a bet in with a bookie. And he was just like, shit, I don't, my bookie's, probably his bookie wasn't fucking with it, but he probably owed him money. He's like, let's just take the bet. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's just like, take the bet. Like, fuck it, let's bet on Mariners. I'm like, well, what are we going to do if we lose? He's like, I don't know, man, we'll figure it out. I'm like, all right. So I told these guys that I had a bookie. So like, I was writing down on a napkin. It was like, this guy wants 1,000, this guy wants 5. And I'm like calling my brother in the payphone, like, but they want 1,000, but what's the pitcher? Isn't there odds on baseball? I'm writing all the numbers down. We watched the whole game. I'm bugging out. Like, I'm running to the side room. I'm running back in there. I'm running outside. I'm like chain smoking. I'm freaking out. And then I find out after the game, and I find out the Mariners win. And,
right. Like, and extra innings, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, that was like Griffey and A-Rod and Tino Martinez, yep, and Edgar Martinez. So I go up, I call my brother, and I'm like, yo, these are all the things. And he's like, man, we won $9,000. What the fuck? And I was like, what? And he's like, yo, send me that shit. I'm like, hell no. I'm like, I'm bugging out here. I'm not sending that shit. We'll split it. So I split it with him, and then he was like, yo, but promise me you're done. And I was like, yeah, I'm done. So I was his little brother. And I'm like, come on, man. I've never held $4,500 cash in my life. So I'm like, nah, okay. I promise you I'm done. So that was like during the week. So Sunday morning, I wake up and I get like my phone's ringing off the hook. And everyone's like, yo, I want to put in this bet, this bet. I'm like, word? I'm like, fuck it. So I just started taking bets. That Sunday night, it was Tampa, Denver. Denver's 14-point favorites. I mean, John Elway's playing. Like, yeah. That's how long ago this is. I remember this like it was yesterday. They're 14-point favorites. And I basically have everything on that game because at that point, it's like you're talking about just like 20 kids at BU. So they're all betting. They all got their parents' money. They're all losing money. I probably up whatever. You know, numbers probably seemed crazier back then than they are now. But everyone bet everything on Denver. You know, everyone at that point, you down, you double it on Sunday night. So they put everything on Denver. And it was like one of those moments again where like I was like, what the fuck? If I lose this game, not only do I not have the money, but like now I'm out money. I was like, I need Tampa to win. Like they were horrible. Or cover, right?
Yeah.
Tampa loses by like 12 and I get like Monday, people are calling me Tuesday. I'm checking people's names off the list, and that just spiraled into a bookie business. By the time I was a sophomore in college, I had people sending me, I had clients at Wisconsin, clients at University of Miami, clients at Michigan, clients in Berkeley. I had security guards that ran the clubs in Boston collecting for me. I had a marketing professor at BC Night School, because when you're running a book and you're BU, you end up in BC Night School the next year, because I was all fucked up. And I had 125 clients. I mean, holy, I had this guy lose $15,000. I mean, he came in, he called me from downstairs. He's like, I got $8,000 in this TV. I'm like, give me the TV. Like, and I took the shit. Like, and I was crushing it. Then I left school, came back to New York.
Wait, did you leave school because you were conflicted because you were a student athlete and you were like, you want to know what?
I was not a student athlete. I was a student bookie.
Right.
And I left school.
Were people betting on the BU games?
No. But someone tried to double down. Someone was down a lot of money. And he tried to double down on Harvard Yale football on a Saturday, and then then called me later on the night, like, my dad's gonna kill me. Like, you gotta pay me, man.
You had no heart.
I didn't leave school really. Like, school left me. You know. Huh. Like,
it was, wow. Yeah. That's a deep quote.
We weren't seeing eye to eye anymore.
How'd you explain it to your parents when you showed up back in New York?
No. They knew. They got, you know, that they were still.
Wait, were they in like $15,000 in the hole?
No, they were killing it because their son was, you know, a few hundred
fixing the books. Yeah.
Safe in my closet. So I went back to New York, and I remember this kid from Boston was like, let me run your shit in Boston. And I was like, all right, you run Boston. I got this kid in Miami, this kid. I started taking bets in New York. New York's a different animal. And like, long story short, there's a whole different climate in New York. And those people were running an operation in New York, and they weren't trying to have me taking the amount of action I had.
It was you against the OTB?
Worse than the OTB. And that business went away, like, just in the drop of a dime. Like, I remember one night I had to make a choice. Like, if I was going to really, like, go to war for this business on
holy
some,
shit.
Like, Ace Rothstein shit.
Holy
which
shit.
I wanted to, but I...
Your brother told you no, yeah.
Well, my brother was one of the people that told me no. There was people that telling me to go, like, fuck it, keep going. But then I just stopped. And
is it too late for me to tell you yes, like, go to war?
No, it's never too late. There's always action.
Yeah.
But and that day I just stopped and like realized I had to get my shit together.
You stopped cold turkey?
Yeah.
Did you still get phone calls from people?
Yeah, for a while. So from like, so I stopped at 20 or 21. So from like 18 to 20, 21, had a nice bit of money, you know, for me at that age.
And no degree, by the way.
No, nothing.
Yeah.
And then I was back on the Upper West Side, just like fucking around, but I had some money. So like, then from 21 to 23, I probably just spent all the money. You know what I'm saying? Like, at that point, I was just like living in New York, going out every night, traveling, going to Vegas, going to Miami, and just living it up. But I don't regret. That was incredible, because while I didn't get the college experience, I had a bunch of friends that also were out of college or weren't going to college or never were going to go to college. And we just kind of lived it up. Like, I moved down to South Florida for a little while. And that period of time...
You really were like a gangster.
No.
You moved down to Miami.
Oh, yeah. No. I was like, I was chubby and moved to Miami.
Yeah.
But so then when I was down in Miami, that was when I was like, all right, when I go back, it's time to get like a little bit of a life.
Mm-hmm. Wait, but real quick, back to the bookie stuff. You didn't have a cell phone at the time, right?
No.
Like 95?
I had a beeper.
Oh, you did?
I got a cell phone in 96. Same number I have now.
Really?
2 years.
Do you still get phone calls for
no.
action?
No. But I started using my cell phone to do it. But I would take the things and write it on like a loosely, like those like composition books.
Yeah.
Like, those things were like my like writing book, you know, like from the front to the back, I could see like week of 116. Crossing everything out, this the math all fucked up. I'd be up all night like doing with like the old calculator and shit. And then the cell phone came on, and that really confused it. I actually liked the idea of like, if you didn't get the bed in at 1,
mm-hmm.
I really had like 3 hours off, and like I didn't even know I had to wait. I didn't even know my number at 4, you know. So like when the bets were coming in, I knew if everyone took one game that I was probably doing well if that game didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I wasn't adding up the juice or the VIG. So I didn't really know my number. So it was really screwed up. So it was like at the end of the night, I would go and look through all the pieces of paper, look at the ticker on the bottom. Who won the Vikings game? You know, did the over come in? Then add up, be like, oh shit, I won 41,000 this week.
That's crazy.
It was crazy.
Yo, people have all the information on their watch now.
I
like,
know, it's insane.
So you didn't go to any classes. You were just like at home.
No, when I applied to be an agent, it was me, Jay-Z, and Juan applying to be an agent. And Juan and Jay-Z didn't, I think Juan finished high school, but Jay, like, everyone knows he didn't finish high school.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, like, when they ask you for your education experience, I'm like, well, shit, I went to BU for a year. Like, this shit is going to look insane. It ended up backfiring because they were like, they didn't really, I mean, we were going to become agents, the three of us, but, and they didn't have the test at that point. It was different things. You had to show a certain bit of, like, experience, negotiation experience. And I remember, Jay and Juan got in right away and they asked me for some follow-up because it looked worse why I guess I had gone to school for a year and didn't finish.
Really? 20 years ago?
Yeah, well, this is 15 years. So yeah, I swear to God. So they asked me for my transcript.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like telling the attorney, like, you know this shit is going to look horrible. Yeah. Like, and he was like, doesn't matter. They just want to see his transcript. So I ordered my transcript. I'm at my house. This thing comes in from BU, and I open it up, and I'm like, it says like A minus, B plus, B, and I'm like, what the fuck?
I'm like, you were killing it?
No. Listen, I'm like, was I crushing it the whole time? And then all of a sudden, I'm like, wait, this ain't me. And they sent me like this.
Oh, they sent you Tom's.
Tom Kleiman. They ended up sending me this person's transcript from so far back. Like, I don't remember if it was what decade it was, but it was ages ago. Ended up getting my transcript, and this was it. Incomplete.
What kind of clown college did you two go to?
Crazy, right? Incomplete F.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, that's mine.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's it. And I was like, this is insane. Like, and then I felt bad because I have two kids now that are 8 and 4. So I think I only had one at the time. This was probably 6-7 years ago. And I'm like, my poor father busted his ass to send me to school, and this is how I treated him.
Right,
like,
exactly.
This is horrible. Like, this is absolutely horrible. Because
you were hanging
rich.
Out with a bunch of coke heads from Long Island.
You know the kind of Upper West Siders, right? You guys, yeah. I probably feel like you guys are the same, right?
Yeah.
You have money. You have more money than a lot of people in the world you run in. And we can't complain. We
had
nice, healthy parents, and we lived in a really safe neighborhood. But we weren't, I mean, there's apartments in the Upper West Side where you could be rich or you could just be cool. So we were cool. So my father, now looking back on it, I grinded probably to send me to college and I fucked it up. But it's all right. I made the, you know, I think he sees that was part of my journey now, because I wasn't ready, you know, emotionally or socially to be in school or whatever the case was. So whatever route it took, I think he sees, like, all right, now, and he appreciates it.
For sure.
But
and college isn't for everybody.
No.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm like, if my daughter did that, I will flip out. You know, like, beyond the money, just like, how could you abuse that privilege in that situation? Because I know half of our foundation, I mean, Kevin and I started a foundation, and we're partnering we're announcing it in a month, but I don't think it'll get to where it's supposed to get from here. But we're partnering with Loreen Jobs, and we're building this, like, incredible college prep center in DC. And everything about this center is to send kids to college. Kids that come from these underserved communities, kids that don't have a chance, come from broken homes. That's all of our resources and hard work going towards that. I was fortunate enough to just have that from my father, and I just fucked it up. So it's like, that shit gives me perspective in how I parent and how I, like, look at things, because that's crazy. Like, how could I have done that? How could I have gone to college and just been like, oh, I appreciate all your work, saving up your money, drop me off, and I'll see you later. I'm not going to go to school. I'm just going to run a book.
Yeah.
And you can't even have any of my money that I make.
What did you want to go to college for? Had you not?
No,
you
didn't, idea.
No idea.
Like, I did for one quick second. Like, be like, let me get on the basketball team, and that'll be cool. And then I was like, that's not going to be cool. Like, I'm not trying to wake up and do that. And then I was like, girls, like, this shit.
Did you even have a major?
No, I honestly don't know.
Did you even have girls?
Yes. Yes. I did have girls, and I partied. But I, you know, listen, most people roll their eyes at me. I really credit that experience a little bit. I think in a weird way, I was kind of like, as much as, like, city kids think they really have it all and they know it all, and they, like, I got street smarts. Like, what the fuck? Come on, man. Like, that's where culturally we were at, you know, we thought we were exposed to certain things and we weren't.
Yeah.
Right? We just weren't. That wasn't real. Like, we weren't really in it.
Right.
So I didn't know shit. I probably was, like, the most immature of anybody out there because, you know, I didn't have the most, like, functional family. I wasn't in a neighborhood where I had to kind of fight for myself in any way. So in some ways I was sheltered, right? But I was, like, sheltered in this, like, dysfunctional, fucked up family. So now I'm, like, in BU and I'm like, wait, so I'm all by myself. I can do whatever the fuck I want. Like, this is ridiculous. Yeah. Like, there's no such thing as Sunday night, you know? Like, you know that feeling on Sunday night that everyone in the world gets?
Yeah, yeah, where like, it's like, I have to be responsible in the morning or something?
Just
feel
sick. You just start thinking, you're like, no, like, shit. And you start, like, just, you hate everything for a minute on Sunday night. I was like, wait, I don't have to feel that way.
Your whole thing Sunday night was like, Tampa better cover. Like,
now I was just like, well, yeah, Tampa better cover, so Monday's popping.
You and Kevin completed the exact same amount of college time.
No, he probably has a year more credits than me.
That's crazy.
Probably in like piano, but
yeah, yeah.
But he has a year more credits.
So, when you come back to New York before you go down to South Florida, like, do you have any type of plan? Do you have any expectations on what you want
to
do?
So I started like wanting to be in the restaurant business.
Really?
When I went to Florida, because like I'm looking at, you know, I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, I like being out and about, and I love being social and personable. I don't want to be in the club world.
And it's a good front.
It's a good front. No, that I thought about that, and it was like that was like the shit. You know, like you watch these like mob movies, and like except for the maid guys, the only other guy that's like holding it down is the guy who runs the establishment. You know, I'm like watching Carlito's Way. And I'm like, I want that office on the second floor.
Yeah,
I don't want to be all the way in the family bar. I'm not trying to, you know, I'll run the racketeering and I'll work upstairs.
Yeah,
you guys can go catch a body. I'll sit that out. So I'm like,
Richie two times. You get the papers,
So I'm like, I want to do that, you know, I wanted to do that, meaning I wanted to go down and like have my own restaurant. I wasn't really ready to grind.
Were you going to be an investor or are you going to be like just...
Oh, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
Just saying I was going to be down there.
Yeah.
I went down with my buddy Raphael, and he had some connections in the restaurant business, and we were just like, let's learn the business and come back and open a restaurant. But
did you actually learn the business, or did you just like throw money at it and you were like...
Neither. We didn't do a single thing. It was, in my opinion, my final chapter of doing nothing in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Those 5 months, 6 months, I was in South Beach. I was at the Boca Diner. I was at the Intercoastal. We were fishing. I'm 21. I don't even know how I was getting by. I think it was the last of my bookie money because my parents had not given me a dollar at that point. So it was the last of my bookie money. And I'm in Florida, and I hit a wall there. Like at that point, I mean, The Sopranos came out. I was watching that shit. So I was like kind of torn, but like I still want to run my own restaurant with my own bada bing. And then I was like, but what the fuck am I doing? Like, this is insane.
Did you hide your cash like Tony hid his cash? Like,
I know. The opposite. I spent it, which I think like subconsciously I was like, let me get rid of this shit.
Yeah.
Like, this is such like, this is giving me such a false idea of how this works. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not supposed to have, you know, $15,000 in cash in my pocket. I have never worked a day for that money, a real working day. Blew my father's opportunity he gave me in college, and I have no direction right now.
Yeah.
But I knew I was a smart kid. I was pretty connected in the city from a young age. Like, one thing I did was like keep relationships. I knew everybody. I've been out. And like, I didn't, Jason Strauss and Noah Tepperberg built an empire. Richie Akiva runs his club empire. I've known all of them. They're all at my wedding. I've known all of them since I was like young, since I was 14.
Crazy.
Right? But I didn't do that. I just was in it with them. So I knew everybody. And that's what I did. I just partied. So like, I knew enough people that knew I wasn't a fucked up kid. So it's like, I know if I try to get into something, then I have a network of people I could talk to, and I have relationships. I understood, you know, what kids would do. I was one of them. I was a kid that would know about music first, or, you know about a sneaker first. I was in it. I wasn't a sneakerhead. I wasn't a, like, you know, when I listened to Stretch and Bobbito, but I didn't need to wait up.
Right.
Like, if someone had the tape a week later, I'll listen to it then. The only thing I was passionate about the entire time through all of this was sports. So it's like, that was my vice in everything. I knew every basketball player, everywhere they went to college. I knew every team, every GM.
Where their injuries were.
I knew everything. Who I needed to injure in order to cover a spread. Yeah. Like, all that shit. No, but that was it. So it's like, that was my only real passion. Like, I went out and partied and was social, and I was just obsessed with sports.
How hard was it to be a Mets fan in the mid-90s?
Horrible. But, like, but it's crazy.
You didn't buy into, like, Butch Husky and, like, you know?
No, Butch Husky. That's crazy you said that. No, but the thing
we
is...
We bring up Butch Husky on every podcast.
Right. Yeah, you should.
Yeah,
man.
We ring a bell whenever Butch Husky's name is...
I should have said Rich Kleiman, a.k.a. the Butch Husky.
Yeah.
But what happened was I think it's weird, like, thinking about how many teams have won a championship, like a one-off. Like, why did the Dallas Mavericks win the NBA championship like 6 years ago. Like, no one will ever talk about that. Or 8 years ago. That was irrelevant.
They'll talk about it in Dallas.
In Dallas. But I'm saying is, we think the 86 Mets were the shit.
They like, were.
That they were, but they won one World Series, man.
Right. No, and
then, I mean, they came close. 88. They came close,
but you know how many teams win one World Series and then come close? But we swear by them. So it's like, people are like, yo, you're a Mets fan. They suck. I'm like, nah, man, 86 Mets. And it's right. like, but really, I just watched the Doc and Darryl biography the other day.
Yeah.
A documentary, and I'm looking at their numbers, and like, they were good, and I know this is pre like juice era or whatever, right. but their numbers, Doc's numbers were really good. Yes. Darryl's numbers were shit. They really were. Like,
well, he was batting, on a lot of like, drugs. What do you want from them?
But I'm saying, like, even his best years, when people talk about like what could have been, like, it's not like he was Albert Pujols and then all of a sudden he was like, you know, had, was 3 times suspended. He was nice, and everyone, his swing was beautiful, and right. he represented so much, and it was a different era, and no one had seen an athlete like that, and they were really polarizing the two of them. Doc's numbers are staggering. Like, he had five, even the years he would get suspended, he would be like 18-5 with like a 2.2 ERA,
yeah.
and but was like on coke the whole time. Mm-hmm. Darryl's shit was like 250, 30 home runs, right. 85, 90 RBIs. It's good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe it's just like we're well, skewed by the numbers.
Did you play basketball
now.
Better on coke or not?
I, honestly, I have never, ever done drugs. I've never done coke.
Right.
Yeah.
But I probably would have played at BU if I was on coke. I probably would have made a team.
So you... You get all your stuff out of your system down in South Florida. You yeah. don't get into the restaurant business.
I didn't even start.
You,
oh, that's not true. I did some other crazy. Go, all right, go on.
No, I was just gonna say, like, how do you get back up to New York?
So I come back up to New York, and I moved in with my brother, and I told my brother I wanted to go to restaurant school. So I told them I think this was again the last of like my bookie money, right? So I was like, I'm gonna go to restaurant school
to be a chef.
No, but check this out. So I'm just like, I did everything so, like, hastily.
By the books?
No, oh. hastily. So if I, yeah. So I would be like, I want to be in a restaurant school. I would go like in the Yellow Pages, like that night. I would do no research. I would just be like, I got to go to restaurant school. I'm going to restaurant school. Fuck it.
So you weren't doing coke. You were just acting like a cokehead.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember I looked up and it was like NYRC or NYRS. That would make more sense, right? New York Restaurant School. So I'm like, this is it.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's got to be it.
Yeah, it has the name.
I call up and they're like, yeah, we do like front of house, back of house, all this shit. So I sign up for this school. I go down there. It's on Varick Street. It's on Varick and Canal. Varick and Canal. And I go into this school, and I went there for an entire year. It was a kitchen where chefs were training on one side. All these people wanted to be in front of the house or be in the service industry, but they wanted to open, like, their own beefsteak Charlie's and
right.
shit. Mm-hmm. Like, it was really pretty, like, it's the opposite of, like, sophisticated would be what? I don't want to be offensive, but not sophisticated.
Yeah, right. yeah. That's Midtown.
So the shit was horrible. Like, but and they had like a smoking room in there because like, what do chefs do? They fucking smoke.
Right.
So I would go down there like 8 a.m. I don't remember a single person's name from this program. I had this guy that taught us, and I was telling people I was in restaurant school. I started being like, yeah, I'm in the NYU restaurant school. They'd be like, you're in the NYU hospitality program? I was like, well, the NYRS. It's like affiliate, but it was not an affiliate. This was like what's like the beauty school?
Mm-hmm.
You know that?
Yeah.
What's that thing? The one we were growing up. But it was like one of those things. Like those, like, you know, like it wasn't even an associate's degree. It was
right.
Like,
you're going to basically like ITT Tech.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You get your tools.
Yeah. So the whole final project was to create this business plan for your restaurant. So I was like, oh shit, now it's on. So like that was cool for me because I could like go up there and pitch the whole shit and present it. So I came up with this idea for this restaurant called Element. Because, you know, like in the late 90s,
yeah.
like every restaurant had like the one lemon.
Yeah.
All this shit. I was like,
did Element. You put a period after it?
I think it was dot, dot, dot.
Oh. Just the essence of Element.
Yeah, Element. So,
like, I'm intrigued.
So I put this whole business plan together and they were like, now you got like the food part of it too. These were all like chefs learning front of house. That's what I came to realize. So I was like, wow, fuck. They were like, you got to put every dish you're gonna have, the method of cookery, your food costs. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, now I'm in over my head again. So I paid this chick in my class and she did my whole thing. And like they were gonna pass me regardless. It was like, if you go, you pass, right? So I presented and I had this whole thing. And I left and I was like, I got to raise money for Element. And like, I remember it was like, I remember telling someone, like, they were like, well, how much money do you need? I'm like, $4.5 million. And I'm like, they're like, everyone's like, where were you going for the money? I'm like, I know, you know, I know a bunch of people. Like, who the fuck was giving me money?
Richie Akiva.
Element. Yeah, maybe. Element, dot, 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 in a baby blue font. And then I made t-shirts. Like, I had these t-shirts. I had to make these t-shirts before I went away one weekend. I, like, went down to the first t-shirt printing place I saw in the Yellow Pages, made all my friends come down on me, made them all wear Element t-shirts. And I, and then that was it.
Like, you guys were the least popular people to show up at Hot 97 Summer Jam parking lot.
In Element. In your Element. Yeah, in Element. I have that. I'm going to show you. I have that binder with that presentation.
That's amazing. One thing
that the girl wrote. Wait,
why didn't
yes, that the girl wrote.
Why didn't you use that transcript to get your agency?
Oh, my God. I should have, right? I should have. I got, like, the food sanitation certificate, all these certificates through the years. There was just, at the end of, like, one Friday, they'd be like, congratulations, Rich. You're now, like, certified in foodborne illness. So I was like, oh, shit. All right.
So
I'll take it.
You didn't get into the restaurant business, though.
No, no.
So what was the next move?
Next move was, now imagine all the kids I did know. So all the kids I did know from, like, that Fieldston world.
Yep.
When I left college at 18, stayed for the next 3 years.
Right.
Like most of those people did.
Yeah.
I had the whirlwind of 3 years. Miami, partying, booking, getting shaken down from my book operation, restaurant school. I'm hanging with people that I never grew up with, or people that no one from that part of my life would know. I'm just in a whole other world. I'm
yeah.
out in
same
the
clubs, number though.
Same cell. Now they're all finishing school. So two friends of mine are at Cornell. One of them is this kid, Noah Kerner, who now is the CEO of Acorns, which Kevin and I invested in. Very successful. He lives in Santa Monica. Their business is out of Santa Monica, but they raised all their money from PayPal. Really, like, successful company. And he and this other friend of mine had an idea to start this e-commerce community hip-hop website. This is 1999, right?
Wow.
Called One Level. And this is when, like, BET had Volume and Russell Simmons had Hooked.
Oh, my God.
And they were all these, like, everyone was raising money for
yeah.
it. We raised $2 million.
Less than your restaurant.
What?
Less than Element.
Half my restaurant. But all these other companies are raising $50 million. We raised $2 million. Now, let me tell you, and we put this board of advisory together. Let me tell you who's on our board of advisory. Robert De Niro.
Whoa.
Because his son, Rafael De Niro, was one of my best friends in the world growing up. Still is.
Crazy.
I was his best man. He was we were both grooms in each other's wedding. He signs on the board of advisory. Q-Tip. Who I was introduced to by Mark Ronson, and Q-Tip became a board advisor, and then Heavy D, who became, like, one of my good friends. And it's funny because Heavy D, in 1999, when I was not in the music business or anything, when I was just in this, like, hip hop thing, was like, kept telling me that I had. He would be like, bro, you have it. Like, you have that thing. You have that, like, gift of gab. Bro, keep it up. Wait till Puff meets you. Wait till these people meet you. You're going to love it. I'd actually met Puff before because I went on a No Way Out tour with him, 4 dates in 1998. Crazy. And I was in this, like, prayer circle with him and Mace and the Lox. I was in a hotel room in Boston, total little sidebar, and the Lox came flying into Puff's hotel room to show him the video for Money, Power, Respect. They just gotten the video, and they were all watching it in the room.
And you were
crazy.
There.
And I was there. It was crazy. And he had just done the, what was the Godzilla movie? Was it Godzilla?
Yeah. The single with Jimmy Page or whatever?
Yeah, so it's Jimmy Page. So he brought me and my friend into his limo in Boston and played us the Jimmy Page single. So, like, I had known him a little bit. And
wait, did you tell him that the single was garbage?
I was probably like, that shit is fire. That shit is fire. So, and you know, you always hit him with, like, yo, what are you sampling right there, bro? What are you sampling? Oh, I heard that shit. Is that live? Yeah, like the same formulaic questions. That shit live? Yo, you write that shit? So that was crazy. But I remember Heavy D's like, yo, you're going to be just, and he just gave me so much confidence. That dude was incredible. Everything I asked him, he probably was like, man, I don't know what the fuck this guy's asking me, like, this e-commerce, but he just was so supportive of me. He, like, believed in me. It was really, and every time I ran into him in L.A., when he moved to L.A., he was always asking me about, you know, I've been with my wife for so long, so she's just been in it with me.
How long have you been with her?
It's 2018, right?
Yeah.
So 18 years.
Wow.
I've been married for 14, been with her for 18, and we, like, went through all those, like, journeys that you go through when you're single in your in the 20s. Mm-hmm. We were just married. Like, we partied together. We wilded out together. We had tough times. We had good times. And we had kids. And my businesses were all fucked up. She had to go through everything with me.
Wow.
Where I would probably be like, this is the one. You know, like, yeah, this is the one. I mean, this is going to make us. And like, oh, shit, this isn't the one.
Yeah.
She knew when I wanted to be in the restaurant business. She knew when I wanted to own a hip-hop website. So we raised $2 million, blew through the money. We threw a big launch party in the Hamptons on Memorial Day weekend, and that was actually our, like, going at a business party. Because I think the shit ended, like, 2 months later. But Q-Tip and Mark DJed.
That's where your budget went, yeah.
Yeah, it was a good party, though.
It was popping, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was in and Max Glazer. Remember Max Glazer?
Sure.
He, like, opened.
It Rihanna's DJ, right?
Is that?
I think, right?
Oh, I don't know.
Max Glazer? Maybe not.
I have no music knowledge of the last 5 years, so if this happened in the last 5 years. But Jessica Rosenblum threw it.
Mm-hmm.
It was popping. Puff was there. Like, it was just.
Was he still trying to show you that Godzilla video?
No. It was that Conscious Point where, you know, that famous club, and Noah mm-hmm. Jason threw the party. It was fun. But then
Lizzie
it,
ran over a bunch of people.
Yeah, not that night. Not that night. But it, that's where it happened. But that was it. Like, that was it. So. That's June, and I bet we were done in August.
Oh my God!
And we had raised like $2 million. But in that period, we had had this. We got this office on 38th Street. We had 8 employees. We had these like writers from Vibe and writers from XXL, and we had videographers, and you know, and I was the COO, and my friend was a CEO, and one was a CFO, and like we had business cards, and we did the whole shit, and we raised this money. No idea what we were doing, right? These two kids went to Cornell, but really, I had no education, clearly, but I was the one that had, I knew right then, like, I'm gonna make this a business. Like, I'm the same kid that would make t-shirts for my restaurant. I sold toys when I was 8 in front of my house. I ran a book. I would call into sports radio at like 7 and pretend I was different people. I was just always hustling. So, I was like, all right, cool. So we raised $2 million. I'm going to make this shit something, you know? So, like, I was the guy that would go out and talk about it. So in New York circle, like in a really, really small circle in New York, people probably thought, man, Rich got this little .com shit.
Yeah.
But really, of all those companies that were raised the money, like from real VCs and real institutions, we were probably hands down the last, you know, like we.
No,
were,
you guys had Robert De Niro and all of his hip-hop knowledge.
No, but let me, yeah. The thing is, we had this whole write-up in New York Magazine that was like onelevel.com because we had those names.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and we were in like page 6 in like 98, 99. So people thought that like I was onto something, that I'd become like from bookie to entrepreneur and I had this company. But I really, that, you know, we ran out of our money right away. All these other companies, we didn't sell it for a dollar. We didn't do anything.
Right.
Right.
But something clicked in there that I was like, all right, I want to do something. Like, I can't fuck around anymore. All right, so I'm like 22 now or 23, and I'm like, I can't do this. Like, now I've met this girl who probably doesn't want to hear about this internet company anymore. I'd fucked up in college. I'd bookied. I went to Party Miami. I was doing all these things. I was like, well, what am I still obsessed with? Like, what's the constant here? And it was like, I'm obsessed with sports. Like, that's everything.
Right.
So one of my closest friends was selling a show, and he didn't know anything either. He was 23, but he was also, you know, he was a little grindy. He sold a show to Radical Media to do The Life, which was this TV show on ESPN where they would follow athletes around in this, like, you know, basically reality TV now, but it was diary. It was like Diary and MTV, but for athletes. So it was brand new. No one had done that at ESPN. And ESPN had never really produced anything outside of ESPN production. So they let Radical Media, which is like this hip, cool production company, produce it. And my friend Jamie had sold it to them. So Jamie calls me because he's like, well, you got to produce these segments and be our sports guy. Because they knew that I knew everything about every sport. And I had those relationships. Like, I, you know, the fact that I had met Puff, like, and Heavy D and Q-Tip, and I started to meet athletes. And I knew, like, I was hanging out with, like, wide receivers on the Giants. I was just out and about. Yeah. So he was like, you got to help out. So I'm like, all right, cool. So we're this like really small group, and ESPN comes, and we're sitting in there. And ESPN's like, well, who's going to do the music supervision? We only have $250,000 for the music. And I'm like, $250,000? But really what they were saying was, here's $250,000 for 32 episodes. You clearly can't do the music for 32 episodes for $250,000. Now watch us take control of this show again, basically, right?
Right. Right.
So I'm like, Jamie, I'll do it. He's like, what? I'm like, and he just got caught, like, what I was saying right away. So I'm like, I'll do it. I'm going to do the music. And they're like, you have experience? I'm like, yeah, well, I ran this music website and I have a lot of relationships in music. And I was like, just a quick question. What happens if I don't spend the whole 250? And they're laughing. And they're like, you'll spend the whole 250. I'm like, well, what if I don't? And they're like, you keep it. So I'm like, fuck that. So that whole 32 episodes, if you listen to it, it's all Raucous Records. I had Brian and Jared giving me, like, instrumentals to all the Mos Def and Pharoah and High and Mighty. I had all Mark Ronson's beats that weren't going on, like, Nika Costa albums. I had Alchemist beats. I would go to all these, like, indie labels and be like, I'll get your music on ESPN, give you credit at the end of the show. I'll give you $500. You got to sign off on everything. And I did it for 32 episodes, and the number one response for that show was the music. And the theme song turned into the Pharoah Monch Styles P record.
Right.
Life.
Oh, yeah. My God.
And then, so I was, like, the shit was popping. So I was like the music guy. So in between seasons, Radical Media gave me an office to stay there, and they told me, can you do the music for this commercial we're doing? Can you do the music for this Dave Myers Honda commercial? Can you do this for this Chris Milk Nike commercial? Can you do it for this new show on ESPN, this new show on VH1? So they would give me like, here's 50 grand, here's 20 grand, here's 15 grand, here's 50, you know, 50, and whatever I didn't spend, I could keep. So I would go to these producers and I'd go to these artists, and they weren't making any money. So then they started saying, will you manage me, will you manage me? All of them were just like beat slingers for the most part, except Mark Ronson was like, yo, come manage me. And I was like, all right, but if I'm going to do this, you got to let me have your DJ shit. And he was like, I know, but I got a DJ manager. And I was like, nah, man, like, there's no way I can come just do your beats. Like, you got to let me in on the DJ shit. So he let me in on the DJ shit. And you guys know, like, at that point, he was the guy.
Yeah. Did you consider yourself a music supervisor? Did you consider yourself like just a connector?
That's what I was saying, what I was doing. Like, because I, you know, when you're, I was big in the title. So, like, at that point, I was calling myself a music supervisor.
Yeah.
That's always been really important to me. Like, I really feel like it's imperative to, when someone asks you what you do, to be able to tell them what you do. Yeah. Like, if I meet someone and I'm like, so what is it you do? And they're like, well, you know, and I'm just like, man, I can't listen to this shit. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you're talking about. I want to know exactly what you do. So my thing was like, I felt that way early. My goal is not to be famous. I just want everyone to know what the hell I do. Like, I want to be recognized for the work I do because I know I bust my ass. And mm-hmm. I know that I can really work hard and I hustle and I can conceptualize things, execute it, and get it done. And I feel like I'm the best at it. And I feel like I can get in a room with anybody, talk, and get it done. So
even at 24, 25?
I just felt like if I'm in the room, I can get it done. Now, mm-hmm. I was always a bit like enamored by Puff and Jay and Damon and Stout, and I knew them, but I was enamored by them because I was like, man, these guys, like, I thought basketball players were cool. These guys are fucking cool.
Yeah.
So when they let me in that world, I knew I wasn't them yet. You know what I'm saying? So it's like I knew I was the shit in my mind, but I knew they were the shit. So I was kind of like, all right, well, let me fall back a little bit and play my place and be like their young guy. So it's like I really never, you know, maybe I left opportunities on the floor in some ways because, you know, a lot of people in my position would have been like, man, I'm gonna keep building my own shit so I can be like them. I was like, no, let me just be around these people. I'm going to breathe so much of this like positive influence and this mentality and this like genius that I was like, you know, especially for me with like Jay and Stout, like, you know, and John Manili, Jay's manager, who took me around really early and like really pumped me up and saw that in me too and let Jay and all them know. So when I got to be around all that is when I was like, well, hold up, I know I can get anything done and I want people to know what I do, but right now I'm cool with people just knowing I'm cool with them. You know what I mean? So I started managing Mark and going to the clubs with Mark, and then I was managing his sister, and I was managing D-Nice and Q-Tip, and I had this little DJ business popping. Like, I really did. Like, they did a story on the cover of New York Times Style section on me in 2006. You guys look it up, man. It was just about the celebrity DJ.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that shit was a real business. I was
By the way,
money.
Was that New York Times Style section what, like, turned your parents? And they were just like, oh, we get it now. Let me see it.
No, I will say this. In all that, like, I never got the talk, like, what are you going to do with your life?
Right.
It wasn't a Twisted Sister video for you?
No. They knew I like, went to the beat of my own drum. Like, shit was just going to be different.
Yeah.
You know? Like, they knew it, but they knew that when I put my mind to something, I knocked it out of the park. Like, I had an idea for a business when I was 11, which was called Lawyer Kid, and I thought that I could be the lawyer to kids
who felt that their parents were like that there was injustice in their house.
Wow. Wait, did your parents look at you and be like, "Hold on, like what is going through this kid?" Like, dude, do
no,
we?
I think they appreciate it in much.
They weren't like, "Yo, Rich has a problem with us, and he's like not just projecting."
No, I think they knew I had a problem with them because my, like I told you, my house was a little fucked up. So they, I think they were like, "Wow, but look at this! Look how he's channeling what's going on here."
Mm-hmm.
So I think they appreciated that. You know what I'm saying? Or like every time I'd buy a new toy, I would really try to flip it the next day, and I think they thought that was weird. But like. That I don't know why my mind worked like that. I was like, oh my god, I know so and so wants that Cabbage Patch Kid. If I get it from Baronet's on 83rd and Broadway, I could probably sell it for like $5 more. And I'll be like, if I have $5,
yeah, make it tougher for the kid who wants to the doll that badly.
Yeah, I know. And who wants? I mean, what, yeah, exactly. So and baseball cards, like you know, I was like flipping. I always just wanted to do that stuff. So. You know, I started managing all these producers and artists, but the only thing that was really sticking, like I had a bunch of producers and I was in the shit, and I think it was really more about Mark and I. You know, like we had signed some artists we were developing, then none of them made it. We had signed some producers, none of them made it. But Mark and I started, you know, Mark was popping. Mark had Nick Acosta, he did his own album. We had songs with like Freeway and,
yeah.
and all these different
So artists. 2006, you're saying?
Is that when Here Comes the Fuzz came out?
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
So that's when Mark and I had fully... Wait. Now that can't be when Here Comes the Fuzz came out because Fade to Black came out in 2003 or 2004.
Right.
And I produced that, and that was after.
Oh, right. He had a lot of. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This Mark, is all coming together at Radical Mark, Media. And
we, did,
his
and we
beats.
Did the Fader mixtape. Mark's album came out in 2002.
Yeah.
So I was managing Mark from the show, still doing music supervision with Radical Media.
Yep.
Managing Mark, a whole bunch of producers that weren't making it, but Mark was driving my shit, and Mark and I had. Mark was like the guy, the it kid. So we had our little thing. Managing other DJs, being paid from clubs, and I was just hustling.
Were you a part of, is it All I Do or Alito?
Yeah, that was me and Mark.
Yeah.
So we took this studio down on Mercer Street, 19 Mercer, and then like we signed Rhyme Fest,
yeah.
Daniel Merriweather, and you know everyone that was in there was talented. They really were. Like in my studio throughout that run, Amy Winehouse did Back to Black. Like Amy's first trip to New York, she landed. Me and Mark took her to see United 93, the most depressing movie ever.
My right. God, yeah. What?
I know, the Tribeca Film Festival. And
shout out to Robert De Niro.
And then me, Amy, and Mark walked uptown, and like that was like my first experience hanging with her. Like way frank it was out, and she hadn't written one song. And we, like
she had the Beehive and everything?
Yeah, and just walking through, like no one knew who she was, nobody. Adele came to the studio. Adele does not have more than one or two duets in her life, and one of them is with our artist Daniel Merriweather on his album. Adele was in our studio, Lily Allen, Santi Gold, you know, Rhymefest was writing in there, then Wale
came by. Yeah.
Wale was cracking at that point. We just had a great vibe in there. Nobody was like, well, Amy and Adele were superstars, but everyone at that point were not. We just had a cool little thing going, and Jay is like the best at recognizing what is happening. So even though we had no artists out of there, I had produced Fade to Black, got to know Jay really well, was hanging with him all the time, or you know, probably in my opinion, I was hanging with him all the time. I was probably following him.
Yeah.
And
were you at the show?
I was at the show, which is funny, but I was at the show. I had got tickets through someone, through...
Carlene?
No, through Just Ski and Richie Akiva, who were best friends with Jay and all them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I knew Damon, but I didn't really know Jay. And I was at the show, but I didn't film it. Then a little while after, Manili had all the footage from the thing, knew I was at Radical Media, right? So I'm at that point, I'm at Radical Media, and I'm still with Mark and all these producers, and I have Alito.
Yeah.
And John's like, well, let's do something at Radical Media, and that's when I brought Fade to Black. We did the...
So they had the footage without any distribution deal?
Yeah.
Wow.
We brought the footage in. We edited it into this movie. Michael Warren directed the movie. He actually just did the Hillsong movie. You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And
that's Lenny's friend.
Yeah. Lenny's really tied in there. So then what happened was I'm doing both those things. I'm really close with Jay. And then it hit me, like, I got to work with this guy. Like, I just got to work. So I started bringing stuff to him. Brought Wale, brought Daniel Merriweather. He didn't want to sign either at Def Jam, but he knew Mark and I had something, and he knew Mark was, you know, he had known Mark forever. Mark was DJing Biggie's birthday in 1997. Yeah. So what happened was Jay was like, I said, let me, you know, can I come work at Def Jam? He's like, just wait. I'm actually going to do something else. And I was like, all right, cool, I'll wait. You know, this was like towards the end, and he was looking out for me because I would have signed a deal with Def Jam.
Right.
I waited. Mark and I had our thing, and then I went over to work at Roc Nation, and I came with Mark, you know, Mark let me manage him through there, and Wale then turned into a management client, not through the label.
Right.
And Daniel Merriweather too, and then a bunch like Samantha and Q-Tip and D-Nice. I brought them all over as like, that was my management roster. But really, like, they're all incredibly talented.
Yeah.
But that wasn't, I don't think, why Jay brought me, right? You know, like, he had seen like the hard work I put into the movie. We were hanging all the time. I was always calling him, like, I want to bring Wale, I want to bring Daniel. I brought Amy Winehouse up there once. I remember one night we were, I brought her to the Pig, I think the first night they met at the Spot of Pig, or one, you know.
Did you guys play Jenga?
Oh, I played Jenga there all the time, all the time. I mean, the parties we had out there were cracking, but I don't even want to talk about that phase.
Yeah.
And then I went to work at Roc Nation. And it's funny, what I realized right away when I went to work there was everything I had done to hustle my whole life, and in some ways, like, skip steps and cheat the system a little bit. You know, and looking back on it, like, I think that's what I learned a lot from that time. But, like, I was working hard, but I feel like, you know, thinking it back to it, like, well, what happens if I don't spend the money on music? That's what my thought process was. It wasn't like, let me make this the best production there could be. It ended up that I did really good work, and they really, like, credited me for the music on that show. But it was still, that's where my mind was at, you know, and that was the wrong thinking. It was pretty short, but I didn't have money, so that's how I was thinking about it. When I went to work at Roc, I realized how much harder I had to work. I just realized that, like, for everything I had done that, like, to make an equivalent to a basketball player, it'd be like if a basketball player was averaging 20 points, 7 rebounds, 4 assists, and the coach is like, man, you're not playing to the best of your ability. And he'd be like, but I'm averaging 27 and 4. But his potential was a more efficient 24, could probably do double-digit rebounds. He is averaging 4 turnovers a game, so he should cut his turnovers. He's not shooting 80% from the free throw line. So you only see points, rebounds, assists. So it's like I could say, well, I'm managing Mark and Q-Tip and this, but I really wasn't like the best version of myself. And every time I thought I was, I would go to Jay, and he would really – like, in the most practical terms, like, explain to me how much better I could be doing.
So at the time, it's so easy to look back at Roc Nation now and be like, oh, of course, this was a given. But it wasn't a given. This was a brand new operation and out of the traditional, like,
system. Yeah, we were at Roc Aware offices. It was like...
Still are.
Tata. Yeah, well, now, but now it's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tata, Jay Brown, Manili, Jay, me.
Juan.
Juan wasn't there yet. Me, Carlene, there was a few people there, and it was all coming together.
Well, but like, how did, besides working with Jay, like, how was it sold to you? Did you understand what it was going to be?
It didn't have to be sold. For me, it was like, you know, you grow up, I became aware of having a career and identity in a business when Bad Boy, Rockefeller, Rough Ride, that shit was insane. Like, that inspired the shit out of me. Like, to know that them and their friends and them and the people they went to war with had this brand that people in the world were screaming about now. Like, again, like, I put on ice how much I wanted to be in sports. I mean, think about it. I went to work on The Life because of sports. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm done with all this other stuff. Let me go to where I want to be in my life is sports. Right. And then by starting to do the music for that show, it opened my eyes again to the music business. And it's not that I, like, studied liner notes as kids. I'm not fans of music the way you guys are. I don't care. Like, I know it sounds messed up, but it's like I almost have to remind myself because I never really loved music like that.
But is that what made you successful in music?
Maybe, but honestly, I think I was just successful at building my... Not brand, because that mean I don't have a brand, but building my...
It's 2018. Everyone has a brand. You are your own brand.
All right, yeah. But you know what I mean. I don't feel that way. I was just building, like, my experience and learning and building a network and learning business and all the things I had not done. Like, I was just learning all of it. I was understanding law and business and everything. And I really am a sponge. So I really, once I got into it, I was picking it up. And then when I worked there, when I got the opportunity, I was like, shit, this is his second... This is his uncle. Like, this is second act. This is crazy. I'm not missing this shit. So people that were like, well, why don't you just do this shit on your own? You got Alito. I'd be like, man, stop. Like, I got me and Mark, and we got a few artists, and we're in this studio. And we had a moment. It was cool.
Right.
In New York, it was just, you know, Mark would do his Table 50 with Q-Tip. We had a cool little thing. We weren't raucous. Like, we didn't change a game.
By the way, it was no one level, you know?
No.
we went to that SOB show that was a Mark Ronson,
with Alito all those guys.
Showcase, That was a big show.
Yeah, we had you know, we would do that. Like, we threw a show at Highline Ballroom, and Drake was trying to get in, and Cuddy, and Frank. We had
Did
a
you
nice
let him in?
Jay and Beyonce came. Yeah, they all came. Like, we had a nice little moment. We had a show where Will Smith, Justin Timberlake, Jay, Beyonce, Drake, Cudi, you know, they were all like, and it was just because we had a nice little city thing going.
Yeah.
Great group of girls in the room. We just had a nice little thing in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's what it was. So
but
I knew that I wasn't naive enough to think that I was sitting on like my own. Like this wasn't Damon Dash being like, I'm not going major.
You know,
me and Jay-Z and Biggs are changing the world. I knew like this is why I did all this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like we had signed Wale to Interscope and they gave us a joint venture on him. We had signed Rhymefest and Daniel Merriweather to J Records, and they had given us joint ventures for them. But in my opinion, all three of those artists were incredibly talented, but it also had to do with this like conglomerate we had of Mark and I, and Mark a lot, right? It was like Mark was Pharrell or Tim. He was the producer behind these guys. He happened to have a good manager in me, but I don't think there was like, we got to sign Richie's the music guy. I just think they thought, just like Heavy D saw it, or Jay, they just thought like, all right, you know, Jimmy was like, ah, this guy, I get it. This guy's talking business with me. And Mark was Mark.
Yeah.
So
what was the learning curve like at Roc Nation?
Honestly, tough. And it was weird because I was so close with them, but they're savages in business. You know what I'm saying? In a great way. So it's like, I'd be like, yo, I want a raise. He'd be like, a raise? Like, you feel like we're overpaying you. And I'd be like, what the fuck? No one's ever said that shit to me. Like, booking work for me, hustling in music. When I say hustling, mind you, tell your 350,000 listeners.
That's right. That's right.
I'm not talking hustling. I'm talking like my version of it.
Right.
Flipping toys and shit.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But I'm like, I understood that all of that was to like be in this moment, but all of that had really worked for me.
Yeah.
Like for the most part, I was really lucky. Like who fucks up in college, becomes a bookie, gets shaken down, you know, becomes a music supervisor with no experience, gets two joint venture deals at record labels with no experience, is managing the biggest DJ in America, no experience. So I'm just doing it.
Don't sell yourself short. At one point, you were a restaurant investor and a COO at a website.
So this was after Element.
Yeah.
But so like, I was like, shit, what do you mean? I thought Jay would be like, yeah, what's your raise? Like, you're my guy. But they were like, raise. And I was like, oh, fuck. And I realized like, it was cool what I was doing, but I had to really bust my ass. I had to like really work and like, you know, and I needed money then. Like, I was in the city. I was like, this is crazy. Like, but I wanted it so bad, but they really, it was like, you know, when you like do something and you run into your like parents, you're like, yo, is my room clean now? And they'd be like, nah, not clean yet. So I'd be like, yo, I just got, you know, Solange a deal with Absolute for $100,000. Our commission is blah. And they'd be like, all right. I'd be like, man, this shit still ain't good. But then it started making sense to me, like thinking about it, like, all right, well, payroll tax and expenses and this, so what I'm making, that's nothing. They ain't going to give me more money. So I just realized I had to keep grinding. And like, then I started really I felt like I was having a moment in music, which is funny when it all switched.
Mm-hmm.
So like, now I was the A&R on J. Cole's album, on his first album. And like, I don't even think of that as like anything. Like, and J. Cole clearly is a god. Like, I knew he was special the second I met him, right? The second, I mean, I was leaving Jay-Z's house. I was watching football with him. I was starting to earn their respect a little bit of music. And Jay's like, let me play you this song. It was Lights, Please. And like, wow. Come on. I knew J. Cole was special. And but I'm not saying like I knew like I had the ear.
Right.
Like, I'm just saying like I met him and I knew he was the shit. Like,
yeah.
Loves basketball. His god is so like strong in his vision, his belief, his crew loves him and supports him. Their whole energy around them was incredible always. I just wanted to be around those guys, even though they were so many years apart from me. So I was just like, so I was A&R in his album, was managing Solange.
Wait, by the way, is it hard to A&R, or is it easy to A&R J. Cole's album because he does all the production himself?
Well, listen, when I say A&R, like he had Mark Pitts, Jay-Z, his crew. I was like the business A&R. I'm facilitating samples and this and dealing with No ID and dealing with the studio.
Missy Elliott.
I'm in the studio with Cole and telling him what I think, but I know Cole's like, all right, yeah, that's Rich's advice. Like, I'm not listening to him, you know?
Right.
But at that point, him and Jay weren't talking as directly all the time. So I was like, bring Jay a song. And I don't like Trey songs on that hook. I don't like the way Trey delivered that hook. Tell him to go back to it. I was in that. So it was a real thing. I was in the middle of it, but I didn't like creatively put together the project.
Yeah.
But
But back to Solange, sorry.
Well, but what, just so you know, what's funny about me, and I honestly believe this, and I'm starting to get a little cockier now as I get older, because I actually think I'm really now starting to fucking do it.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's cool. A lot of people, like Kevin always tells me to like talk that shit, because I'm not that guy, but I feel like it starts to. So I'm going to talk that shit for a second.
Let's go. If Kevin says so, then do it.
Yeah.
When I think about it, though, do you know how many people would still, with their Twitter bio, would be like A&R J. Cole? Like, that was like a thing that I did. It was just on the list of these things that I've been a part of. But I don't, or like producer of Fade to Black, A&R J. Cole album. They would write that now on their Twitter bio, and it'd be 15 years since that shit came out.
For sure. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So sometimes I'm like, you know what? I did A&R his fucking album, but I just don't look at it like that. I don't want to be disrespectful. I don't claim in any way to have, like, I've discovered anything. I just was a part of it.
But isn't that sort of the stunt right there?
Yeah, like, where you're just like, I did it and it doesn't even matter to me.
No, because, but I guess maybe. Yeah, that's, if it sounds that way, then good. But yeah. I mean, it's just like, I played, at that part point, I was a part in it. You know?
Yeah.
So I just played a part in it. But, you know, and then we had, Wale had a label going on, and he had just done Ambition. That shit was like first week, whatever. I was managing Meek, who, like, I knew Meek, I wanted to manage the second I met him, because I was like, Meek walks like a ball, like, you know, like Jay said, like, walk like a ball player. I'm like, Meek is the baddest motherfucker in this room. Like, his swag was on a trillion when I met him, and I was like, I love this kid, like, I want to be around him. His boys were insane, like, amazing. I just loved it.
Yeah,
their energy got me so excited to work with them. And it's funny, because I actually think I was at, like, the growing pain stage for a lot of artists when I was working with them. Like, Cole was struggling. He had his vision with A&R. Meek was, like, he was popping, but, like, you know, Meek was the biggest artist in the street, but he had to get his infrastructure and everything together. Wale is always stressing, right?
Right.
And I was always in that with him. Solange, I was managing her at the part when she was, like, really evolving into her own brand. She always was her own thing, but really taking that next level. But I wasn't there for, like, the smash. But she put an Instagram post out, like, a month ago, and thanked a bunch of people in her life and thanked me. And I realized, like, yeah, I played a part in it. Again, I just played a part in it. But I had a little thing going at that moment in music.
Were you at the Were you at the listening at Electric Lady for Meek's first project?
I threw it, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I threw it. Meek Will was Smith so late and... that Will Smith and Jay left.
Yeah.
Victor Cruz, and Cruz was my guy, so he came with me. And then Jay and Will Smith came and they left
because Meek didn't show up. I remember,
until late.
But by the way, the feeling when they played the intro in that room, Angie Martinez, everybody, it was crazy.
That's what I'm
crazy.
Saying. I threw that whole thing. Like, I was just, these were my things. Like, I did it. And I was like, so now I'm like on tour at MMG and like doing this and like, but what I will say is I was realizing then that I ain't love it the way they loved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't love music. I loved the energy of Meek and Ross and Solange. I just like, you know, I just love, she's like a dear friend of mine. I'm at her wedding. This is my friend. So I loved that shit. I loved it, but wasn't passionate about it. I was passionate about sports. So I met Victor Cruz and I started hanging with him, and he was friendly with Lenny and he was like in the Roc Nation world a little bit, but he didn't really know Jay. And I remember I tried to tell him I wanted to manage him, and I said to Jay, like, Wale actually introduced me to Victor Cruz. He knew I was a big Giant fan. They just won a Super Bowl and we were at a Grammy party. And like Wale brought me over to him and I was like, you know,
yeah,
it was my guy. So I said to Jay, I want to manage Victor Cruz. And he said, well, hold up, I got something. And when was the last time in my story he said that about Roc Nation? So now I'm like, oh, shit, he got something. I got to wait again. They just told me later on they had Roc Nation Sports. And Juan, like, was incredible. Juan and I always talk sports. And Juan told me, he just, like, it was amazing. Juan just was like, bro, you're going to be my vice president of sports. Like, and that was the first time in my life that someone had, like, really, you know, without me having to fight for it, someone had just been like, you know what? I appreciate what you've done. I see it. And Juan really did that. And Jay supported it. And always, obviously, you know, Juan and Jay have to be in cahoots with it. But like, Juan really empowered me. He was like, yo, sit in this meeting. Talk. You run the meeting. Or sit with Geno Smith. Sit with Robinson Cano. Sit with whoever. You run the meeting. So, and I was just like, shit, how in God's name did I get so lucky to jump off the tracks of sports? Like, 12 years earlier when I was doing the life, and now I get a second chance to do what I love. As soon as I sat in a meeting with an athlete, I was like, this is where I was supposed to be my whole life. I understood the business of sports, the collective bargaining agreement, athletes, what they're going through. And I just knew it. It was like that was what I had my degree in. It was just sports.
Right.
Now I'm in that business. So it was like, this is insane. So we were all sitting in the room and we were like, well, who should we sign? We're like, we should try to get KD. And I'm like, I could call him. Because I met KD when he was 18. Wale said, yo, I grew up with KD. Will you bring him to the Jay-Z show? I said, sure. Brought him to the Jay-Z show. I'm with KD. KD, I said, Manili hit me. It was like, Jay wants to meet Kevin. Or not meet him. He already knew him. He said, or maybe they didn't know each other. He was like, bring Kevin to the back. And I was like, all right, Kevin's like, nah, I'm not ready to meet him, man. I don't feel like, you know, Jay-Z is my idol.
Okay? Whoa.
So I was like, damn, this kid is special. Like, who passes up this opportunity? And knowing Kevin Durant now, think about how you guys see him as a public figure. That feels like it's totally in line, right?
Right.
Whereas, like, everyone else have been like, yeah, bring me back. Kevin's like, I'm not ready.
Right.
So I was like, Kevin and I just kept in touch. So, again, that was like a weird foreshadowing. Like, why would someone 12 years younger than me, I'm 30 at the time, he's 18,
mm-hmm.
and we come from completely different backgrounds, but we just talked ball and caught up, and him and Wale, you know, obviously Wale would always tell Kevin and Victor Cruz, like, Rich knows everything about sports. Rich is my fucking guy. Like, yeah. I love Wale, you know? Like,
yeah.
Wale, as crazy as he was, always went to bat for me, always asked about my wife, my kids, my family. You know, he drove me absolutely insane, but I absolutely love him still to this day as much as I did back then.
That's awesome.
For him,
yeah.
You know? So we called Kevin. It took a while, but Kevin comes to work at Roc Nation. And now I'm in the sports business. And I remember I was on my way down to D.C. for Kevin's Nike Skills Camp. I told Jay I want to stop doing music. He thought I was crazy. I said, I have to stop doing music. I can't answer a phone call with Kevin Durant about Wale or Meek Mill. It's a different world.
Right.
Mm.
So I don't think he believed that was the right thing to do, but he, again, they supported it, which was amazing. You know, him and Juan really supported that. And I got out of music completely. And it's funny, when I spoke to every one of them to a man, Wale, Solange, Mark had already, like, fired me at that point. It's funny because Mark's, like, still my best friend. He's my daughter's godfather, but he fired me twice. He
fired me. Were those tough conversations, or was it like, oh, no, this is coming?
No, it was tough.
Yeah.
The second one was tough, but when you're as close as we were. And, again, I don't blame, you know, I blame him. I think I was killing it, actually.
Yeah.
But he probably felt, you know, he probably felt he couldn't, like, reprimand me maybe the way he wanted to talk to the manager. But so, I, you know, and I had, it was like Solange, Meek, Wale, I don't remember who else. A bunch of DJs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like Samantha, D Nice, maybe.
So what's the difference
between... No ID, I was managing at the time. Because they put me on No ID.
Like, wow.
They signed him. I didn't sign him, but they were like, you manage No ID.
You could have A&R'd 444. Are you kidding?
No, I would have been out by then. All I told everybody I was leaving to do sports, and everyone was like, thank you. Like, we knew... Like, Solange was like, I'm so happy for you.
That's
like,
awesome.
They, you know...
What's the difference between dealing with music executives and sports executives?
You don't mean that question. Come on. That's like, because you guys are too awesome to ask that question. That's like a question I would get asked, like, in an article in Sports Business Journal. We're having a dope conversation. Who cares about that? I don't even know. But come on, man. We got the story popping. So I'll wrap up my whole trajectory so we can tell you where I am now. So basically got really deep in with Kevin.
Yep.
And I told Jay once again, this is why they probably think I'm annoying as shit, because I am always changing my mind and always switching up. And I could see where they would think I'm fucking nuts, but they always supported me. Is then I said, Jay, I can't do sports. I just have to do basketball. It was always something with me, because my mind's always spinning. So I was like, trust me, basketball, football, and baseball are three different entities. I can't. It's like being in film, TV, and literature. I got to do basketball. Now, they were doing everything because they owned and run the company.
Yeah. You know?
But I was in the trenches recruiting and everything and learning all the networks, GMs, and sneaker companies. I had to learn everything that I knew in the music business. I had to learn it quick.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm 5 years in. I know everybody. But 5 years ago, I only knew certain people. I had to learn the business quick.
Right.
So got into basketball only. I had a nice roster of athletes. And then again, I went back to Jay. And I was like, yo, I got to work with Kevin myself. Like, I got to just work with Kevin. And he was like, what? Like, again, I was like, listen, Kevin wants me to just work with him. This is its own enterprise. Just like you or LeBron or Rihanna. This is his own business. And I got to get in it. So at that point, I started running his foundation with him, running all his brand deals. I only work with him, managing him, being his agent, everything. And then another year later, I went back to Jay, and I was like, I'm going to go work for him, and we're going to start our own business. And again, they supported me, man. Like, they always supported my moves every time I needed to move around and do shit. And
that's incredible.
I went to work with Kevin directly, and now we have our own enterprise, you know? And obviously, we still work with Rock all the time and partners, but – instead of working directly for them, I work directly for Kevin, and we still work as a partnership. But me and Kevin started this company, the Durant Company, and that's our private equity investments in Silicon Valley, and I've become like enmeshed in that world. We have a company, 35 Media, that we have a partnership with YouTube and Apple that we're announcing in the next 2 weeks. Have a scripted show that we're working on. It's incredible. And then we have our YouTube network, which is taking off. And then I'm still managing him and his brands and his life, his basketball, still his agent. And we've built this business and big foundation. And that's my job now. And I've never been happier. I'm in the right place. So now I'm like, all my hustling and business kind of prowess is, that's what I do. I'm a businessman and an entrepreneur and an executive. My business partner just happens to be Kevin Durant. So mm-hmm. now I get to go to basketball games and be in the NBA and be in that world. But I'm really just...
And all because Roc Nation wouldn't give you a raise.
Well, maybe. All because... no, that's not why. But it's because they definitely kept their foot on the gas for me. Like, they put a foot on my neck. Like, they, it was never... And it's funny because I don't know if they're like that with everybody. I don't know how they are with everyone. But, like, I remember going to, you know, Jay's house and talking to him and trying to ask him for a raise and him explaining to me why I didn't need one. And then going home and Jana, my wife, being like, did you get the raise? I'd be like, no, but... Man, Jay made a lot of sense, though. And like, it would inspire me. All of them. Desiree would give me these talks and inspire me. Juan, like, you know, like, everyone had a different perspective on it. Jay, the most, would always, like, really put things in these practical terms. But everyone, you know, Tata gave me hard times at once because I think they didn't want me to take my friendship for granted or, like, any comfort level I felt in what I was able to do easily just because of, like, maybe some of my skills in business, but really understand real hard work. Like,
right. They
really
wanted you to understand it was a business, not a clubhouse.
Yeah.
Like, you exactly. weren't there just because, like, yeah. you're and friends they, with all these people.
Exactly. And they really drilled that home. Like, anything, you know, I there's so much that I realize that I'm doing now that I'm kind of running this enterprise with Kevin, and I'll find myself, like, mimicking something that I learned from Jay or watch someone do, or how, you know, because it's like I saw it all kind of come to fruition. It's incredible, man.
Is there anything beyond Kevin, do you think?
Well, again, there's already so much beyond Kevin, in quotes. It's just he happens to be my partner in all of it. So it's like, whereas, like, you know, Jay, Tata, Jay Brown, Emery, all those guys are partners in everything.
Mm-hmm.
It just, my relationship with Kevin grew to the point where we were doing so much together, but it only made sense that we just became partners in everything. So right. if we sell a show or we build out a network or we have a new deal or something or a branded content deal, it's Kevin and I. If I were to decide to open, you know, that Element tomorrow,
yeah.
he would be 50-50 partner with me at Element. So that's how.
Are you ready to give him 50% of Element, though?
Yeah. I give him the whole shit.
How many of his shadow accounts on Twitter do you run?
Man, there are no shadow accounts on Twitter.
Can you just talk about that time in terms of, like, free agency, what that was like for you? Because mm-hmm. it's a lot on the line. It feels like.
Yeah. Well.
And the reason I asked about, like, the difference between, like, executives in music and executives, like, you're not going to have a situation like that. Like Wale going to meet with, like, Todd Moskowitz and Joey Ie to sign over at Asylum isn't like going to meet with, like, the Boston Celtics.
No. In terms of, like, the level of scrutiny, stress, and eyeballs that were watching that, I may not have anything that ever parallels that, right? That was, like, July 4th weekend, and if you didn't know basketball, you knew that was happening. And that was, like, the top news story. It was insane. It was the most exciting time of my professional life, hands down, but at the same time, I felt so much anguish for what he was going through.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really stressed for him, but I was, like, on a high because it's like when a pilot, like, loves flying through a storm or something. I really was just like, holy shit, like, this is why I sold toys and bookied and this. Like,
yeah.
This is, like, I grew up fantasizing about this experience, and I'm the captain of the ship now, you know? Or, you know, Kevin's a captain, but I'm the co-captain.
You're
the
like the pilot of the storm. No, the plane in the storm, yeah.
For sure, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, it was crazy, but that was like, you know, you have, like, different coming out parties in your life. That was, like, a big one for me because I felt like, wow, like, I mean, I ran the meetings, you know, and it's like Pat Riley and Danny Ainge and Greg Popovich and Steph Curry, Bob Myers and Klay Thompson, Draymond Green and all these guys. And me, Kevin, Charlie Bell, and his dad. And we're like, and I'm, you know, and we're talking basketball and marketing and quality of life and living, but really basketball. Kevin didn't talk anything but basketball. Not a single solitary question about anything but basketball. And he is so laser focused on the game of basketball. No one will believe it. People think we went there for Silicon Valley or he's ring chasing. That was a quality of life for him and basketball decision. But for me, it was insane. It was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it was amazing. I just, you know, I felt bad for him. He struggled so hard. But the last day was tough. The stress got to me because I saw how stressed he was. Mm-hmm. Like, he was stressed the whole time, but that last day, I was like, gosh, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, we made the right decision.
What was it like when he won that ring for you?
He won the ring for you?
Isn't that sick?
This is why you did all that stuff.
I heard that in like a timeout with like maybe 3 minutes left, Steve's like, we all know why we did this.
Right. It's for Tom.
It's for Tom. No, but it was amazing. I was just so happy for him and his family. And like, you know, he didn't just win. He dominated those five games. He was incredible. So that felt really good to see.
Were you at the Rucker game?
No.
No.
No. It was not. I was in the city and talking to him when that was happening. Like, those are one of those things where you're like, I can't believe I didn't go.
Yeah. I mean, the videos live on forever. But
yeah. Yeah. You ever see the animated video we did for it?
No.
It's really cool. That sucks you didn't see it.
Where can we find it?
On our YouTube online page.
There was a 1996 New York Times Styles piece. Go look it up.
It was on the YouTube, Kevin's YouTube channel.
Do you have any thoughts on Lil B?
Who?
Lil B.
Who's a bass god?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Bass god. Oh. No, I'm glad he doesn't have a, what is it, a curse?
A curse, yeah.
A curse. I saw that Kevin is no longer, I mean, he clearly, I don't know how the curse, I mean, why am I going to talk about him? He'll end up, right? If God forbid he ever heard it, it's just like.
Right, bass god forgive, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Obviously.
But he did forgive him, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but so.
Did he forgive you? That's the real question.
He might not even know who I am. He probably has no idea who I am, but whatever he's doing is pretty genius, right? Like, I don't mean this disrespectfully. I don't know, does he make music?
Yeah.
Oh, so I don't know any song he's ever made, but he's famous as shit.
Yes.
So he's got he's a little bit of a genius. Like when he put out his list of people that he's putting the curse on, of people that he's not, and then Gordon Hayward's like, "Thanks, bass god, I appreciate it." I'm like, "This guy is a genius. He's a marketing genius." Like, I need bass god to help us. Like, I should get bass god to help us with our Nike camp. Like, roll out our KD Nikes. How sick would that be?
Amazing.
The KD 11 curse.
Yeah.
Oh, with the bass god.
Yeah. Listen, if you need to get connected to the bass god, I have his number.
This is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like this. Tell bass god I got a really cool idea. I hope he'll do it.
You don't tell bass god. You put it in the air,
and bass god hears it.
Yeah.
It's like Kaiser Soze.
Yeah. It's like Mike Kaiser Soze.
Mike Kaiser Soze. No, I really like that idea with the bass god. I don't know. I got to ask Kevin, but I really like it.
Great. I'm glad that this meeting was so successful.
Yeah.
It was so stressful until the last day.
Jeff and I are the CEOs of It's the Real, and you're the COO, you know?
Yeah. I like it, guys. Let's throw a launch party.
That's right. $2 million in.
$2 million launch party.
I'm so glad that you stopped by here and that we have you mic'd better than the Bill Simmons podcast.
That's by design. Yeah. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I'll never be mic'd in those podcasts. I think this was fun, man.
It was a lot of fun.
It was very therapeutic for me.
Oh, I'm glad.
I feel like that was like, do you guys feel like it was a little bit of a therapy session?
For us?
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Well, you know,
for
we're sure. Jews, so, you know.
We didn't talk. Everything's a therapy session. Yeah, you're right. You're right. A little Upper West Side apartment. We just need like one of those sound machines.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally. Well, and like a therapy session, our time's up. So.
Oh, shit. All right, guys.
Yo, Rich, thank you so much for coming through.
All right. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. It is real.
Yeah.
All right, fellas.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode of A Waste of Time with It's the Real Jeff. If people want to find out more about us, I'm Eric, you're Jeff. We're It's the Real collectively. If people want to find out more about this podcast, it's called A Waste of Time with It's the Real. We have 167 episodes, I believe. Jeff, if people want to find out where they can find out more about Eric and Jeff, of It's the Real, of A Waste of Time with It's the Real fame, where can they go?
You can always go to itsthereal.com, ITSTHEREAL, no apostrophes, no spaces.
Go check on all of our old shows, all of our upcoming shows. Any update, they will be on itsthereal.com. Go there today. You can also find all of our episodes for our podcast. Search for A Waste of Time with It's the Real on iTunes, or go to soundcloud.com/awasteoftime. We are on Stitcher, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
That is right. We are now available on your Android phone,
all
where we were not before.
Out there.
Yeah.
Come to us in 64-bit.
There. It is a blessed day that we are now on Stitcher, because now people can stop adding us and letting us know that we are not on Stitcher.
Right. Go listen to us in slow motion, 8-bit.
Blurry camera.
Audio.
Yeah. You can always find our music. Go to Spotify. Go to Apple Music. Go to Tidal. Go to Google Play. We are on all of those streaming services. You can listen to Teddy Bear Fresh by It's the Real. Our song Sugar High is at 550,000 plays.
Just about.
And you can listen to that. Follow us at Twitter at It's the Real. Facebook at It's the Real. Instagram at It's the Real. If you want to find us on Snapchat, we are It's the Real. If you want to find us on Twitch, we are It's the Real. It's the Real. We haven't used Twitch yet, and we barely use Snapchat, but it's there.
Jeff, this podcast isn't going anywhere other than Los Angeles, where we're currently at right now. Actually, we should say that we went to JFK International Airport this morning to fly out here to Los Angeles, and we were walking through TSA, and one of the TSA agents was like, hey, take off your jacket.
Right.
And then we were like, oh, no problem. But he was also like, I love your podcast, to each of us, which is really awesome. So shout out to him. And he's not the only guy from JFK who's told us that he likes the podcast.
No, so shout out to all of our friends at JFK, TSA. Thank you for letting us get through security unscathed.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Jeff, the goal is for everyone out there to tell one friend or one family member or one doorman or whoever they want. Go to the grocery store, tell your local vegetable guy about A Waste of Time with It's the Real, because we want to double our audience. We are tired of being the underdogs. We know it starts with us, Jeff. Who do you want to shout?
I want to shout out someone who came up to us after the show at SOB's. His name is Daniel Bonilla. That is B-O-N-I-Y-U-H on Instagram, even though it's B-O-N-I-L-L-A in real life, I'm sure. And I had a good conversation with him after the show. I hope he comes out to the next one. And yeah, shout out to Daniel Bonilla from Long Island.
Jeff, I want to shout out our friend Abigail Weintraub, who has let us graciously record this from her own home here in Los Angeles. She has issues with people stopping by her apartment uninvited, but we are not that crack-spoken neighbor. We are invited into the house, and we have just taken up her time and asked her to turn off every appliance here in her own home.
Yeah.
But Abigail is so nice that she has let us ramble on for the last 21 minutes and 13 seconds.
Abigail also showed us she has a fake butt in her closet.
This is true. Abigail also explained why she has an ashtray that is, like, misshapen.
Abigail also went to high school with Jamal Jamot, who's coming up on a future episode.
And Abigail also went to high school with
Lin-Manuel
Miranda.
Yeah.
That's what you should take away from this whole thing.
Yeah.
So shout out to Abigail. Thanks for being so friendly and so welcoming to us whenever we come into your city, whether it's New York City or Los Angeles. Jeff, as always, not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We'll see you guys next week.